Welcome to Can You Keep a Secret? Media Rights and the Need to Know, as part of the Wheeler Centre's Fifth Estate series, hosted by Sally Warhaft, co-editor of A Secret Australia's Peter Cronow, and contributor and former Greens Senator Scott Ludlam, join Sally Warhaft for a discussion about what is kept from public view and why, as part of Bendigo Writers' Festival. We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this recording takes place, the Djadjawurrung and the Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nations. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Good morning, everybody, and a very, very warm welcome to this Bendigo Writers Festival session brought to you by the wonderful Wheeler Centre for Books, Writing and Ideas in Melbourne. My name is Sally Warhaft and it's an absolute pleasure to be hosting this tonight. This morning. before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge that the Bendigo venues in this wonderful place that we're meeting today acknowledges the Djadjawurrung peoples as the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are gathered, and we acknowledge and pay respects to all the elders. And also I've just been made aware that Ulumburra, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, which is the name, of course, of this theatre, means gather together in the Djadjawurrung language. So that's a lovely place for us to be meeting. Just to let you know that we will be taking questions for this session via text message, and that's the number up there. So anytime you can text a question and I will get it here, and a little bit later on in the conversation I can get to some of your questions. And both our authors will be signing books at the end of this. So let me welcome our guests, and it is an absolute pleasure to have Peter Cronow here, investigative journalist. He's worked at Media Watch, Background Briefing, 7:30 Report and Four Corners, where he was last working as a producer. He has recently formally retired from the ABC, not playing golf yet. Peter's a Gold Walkley Award winner, as is WikiLeaks, and he is co-editor of this book, A Secret Australia, revealed by the WikiLeaks expose. And it's mainly this book that we're going to be talking about today. And can I just say, Peter, that it's a really substantial book. This I enjoyed every essay in it, and it's really up to date, and it's got a lot of new information in it. And I don't say things about books that I don't mean. it really is terrific.
That's
so
great.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That's great to hear that. And I've got to say it was a work done with a co-editor.
Felicity Ruby. Felicity Ruby.
And we managed to get a very disparate bunch of people, you know, from journos to actors to academics to all sorts. And the aim was to seek out those sorts of opinions that were out there about what WikiLeaks had managed to do.
Yeah.
They weren't hard to find. People who had views and opinions about WikiLeaks, and we were looking for the positive things that people had learnt from the years of WikiLeaks revelations, and everyone had their own different perspectives on it, we're sort of pleased that it came to such a broad group of people.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit in there for everyone. You don't have to start at chapter one. You can dive in and read a couple of the short ones and bounce around as you feel like it.
Yeah, so. No, it really does. It brings you right up to date and gives a perspective on what it's meant for Australia. And one of the fabulous authors in the collection is Scott Ludlam, who it is also a pleasure to have you here. Scott, of course, is a former politician, a federal senator from 2008 to 2017 and deputy leader of the Greens. He resigned. I think, were you the first one to resign in the great constitutional scandal of, when was it? What year?
July 2017, that kicked off.
July 2017.
I had a very lonely 4 days and then all of a sudden I had all this company.
Yeah.
Feels like a long time ago.
Starts to feel like a long time.
And I'm sure you are, well, I can't be sure, but I imagine you are much more sorely missed within those buildings than you miss the building itself. Would that be fair?
I couldn't possibly comment. I do miss it. Every now and again I miss it. I miss estimates because I'm a nerd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
There are things that you can't replace about that particular job.
Well, Scott, as well as his work in this collection, which also includes an interview with Julian Assange, has also just written a memoir, Full Circle, and I'm sure that will be available as well. So let's get into it. And, Peter, I'm going to start with you and Scott will jump in. With a broad question that, you know, WikiLeaks changed journalism. Tell us broadly how and why it was so important.
Well, there's obviously always been leaks coming out of, you know, the powerful institutions that govern us all. But the major difference with WikiLeaks is what Julian Assange called scientific journalism, which meant that you don't just pull a sentence out of a 50-page document and base your story around that. You publish the entire document so that your audience has an opportunity to read it all for themselves. Now, that annoyed the hell out of all sorts of commentators and journalists because they wanted to be able to choose what the public got. So it's kind of WikiLeaks is leaks on steroids, you know. You're getting the full hit of information of a particular document that's being released and not just one person's version of it. So WikiLeaks publishes an appraisal of a document. So they do journalism. He is a journalist. And as a result of that, people can then read that, get their view from that, but then dive into the original document. And that's been one of the most amazing things. All of the other major media have had to follow suit. The ABC now does. Not entirely, but almost entirely, we put full documents there for the public to click on and have a good read, print out, whatever. Because, you know, we don't want to be the only gatekeeper. It's important to leave the gate ajar so that the public can use the information how they want. Maybe they'll see it differently. Maybe they'll pull out other information. Maybe other journalists might want to do that. So WikiLeaks was a far more collegiate way of doing things, and it's changed the world of journalism as a result. It's now an incredible library. You don't hear WikiLeaks in the headlines like you did years ago, but it's a library, an archive, and lots of journalists, I do, I use it as a Wikipedia of leaks, and I pop the names of people that come up into the search engine of WikiLeaks, and you'll be astounded that some of them have got some great mentions. So it's an ongoing resource to be used, but it's also, you know, 100% reliable. They've never made a factual error in terms of getting facts wrong. They'll apologise. WikiLeaks will apologise when it gets things wrong, but it's still waiting to find a serious mistake like that. And it's still open for business as well. The leaks that have come out about Australia are just amazing. You know, it's opened my eyes to how the powerful forces in my own country are manipulating me and everyone else. And those leaks are still open. So to any public servants out here or people in industry or anyone who's tried to complain or do something about or fix a problem in their own organisation through their normal course, if that's run aground, then you may want to consider WikiLeaks.
Scott, what for you has been most important about it?
I think what they've done is really short-circuited the gap between this enormous artificial image of how power operates and how benevolent power is in our own country and in the United States, but really all around the world, and the gruesome truth. And sometimes it is hard to look at. The book is a really great collection of essays and different points of view, all focused less on the disinformation campaign that has thoroughly swamped Julian and his colleagues for the last 10 years, but more about the purpose of the work, what we learned about our country from it. And that's why it's great to be having this conversation. Let's drag it away from Julian's cat or whether he washes his socks often enough and talk about what do we learn about power? That's the most important thing. The archive is meticulously indexed. You can go back now through a 15-year archive of how power operates from the very first leaks that they were showcasing in about 2006 about corruption in Kenya all the way through to, yeah, as Peter suggests, as hard as they've tried to smash this thing, it's actually still open for business. And Sulette Dreyfus has a great essay in the book about a couple of their other innovations, one being this encrypted Dropbox whereby the journalist can't betray the source if the journalist doesn't know who the source is. Mm. So the ability, that kind of cutout, to be able to protect the person who's leaking the material. And the partnership, the agreement to WikiLeaks is a very small publisher, relatively speaking. It was only a handful of people when they kicked it off. But they partner with The Guardian and Le Monde and with Fairfax, yes, and with The New York Times and The Washington Post to get maximum impact out of the material. And so these things, which were quite innovative, I guess, when they were kicking them off, that's now, you see that quite regularly. Mm. They really broke new ground. The most important thing for me on a morning like today is that this has had consequences. People have had their reputations and their lives destroyed, and we can't just sit back and appreciate that work, in my view, without lending a hand for the people who it's put in harm's way.
I feel like I've learned as much about how power operates in Australia and the world in government response to WikiLeaks, yeah, as I learned from the Trove itself. Is that a reasonable call, yeah, Scott?
Yeah, it's incredibly instructive that I think you're spot on. We learn about how power operates from the archive. We learn how power operates when you annoy it from the reaction, mm-hmm, a decade-long campaign of disinformation, character assassination. The crazy thing is we know what kind of techniques they're about to deploy because they were leaked to WikiLeaks. So this slide deck that got leaked in about, yeah, 2011 by H.B. Gary and Palantir, mm-hmm, demonstrated, it was a pitch document. Here's how you smash a distributed, stateless publishing network like WikiLeaks. Here's how you destroy trust. Here's how you ruin their reputations. Here's how you dismantle them, particularly with an emphasis on driving moderate support away. Mm. Get Glenn Greenwald out of the room, get The Guardian out of the room and leave these people isolated with their reputations destroyed. And when that pitch document was leaked, of course, that little consultancy scattered. But you can then see them executing elements of that strategy right up into the present day. That is extremely instructive. They do that to Julian, they can do that to any one of us if we piss them off.
Mm. Mm. It's like a playbook of how to destroy a media organisation. Yeah. And incredible that it was leaked to WikiLeaks. Its own demise was forecast in the leak.
Which is kind of funny. But then they've gone ahead and done it in a vastly more professionalised way than those slides indicated. It's been done by people who are very, very good at their jobs, which is why we're still sitting here having this conversation.
And he's in the clink in London.
Yeah.
Incredible.
In the balance between national security and freedom of information, was there anything that WikiLeaks published that crossed that line?
Well, there's been lots of allegations made about WikiLeaks publishing secret details of individuals and their contact details and things, but certainly the evidence is that those things were published by others first without approval of WikiLeaks. And I think WikiLeaks chased up published leaks, was it by The Guardian, days after, yeah, by publishing similar material because they didn't want The Guardian to be the sole controller of the material. And suddenly out of their hands, they had the information revealed through the password being published in a book by a Guardian journalist. And so therefore WikiLeaks jumped and did put out that information, but it wasn't the first. It didn't do the damage. The damage was done. And however, it's still a very convenient way to kick WikiLeaks to say that happened. And unless you know the nuance of it, it sounds like a very bad criticism. But the nuance is always worth knowing in these things. The people who are trying to destroy WikiLeaks are very skilled at marginalising journalists who don't fit in, marginalising media organisations. They do it for a living. They do it for a living. Mm-hmm. So and WikiLeaks is not the first target, but, boy, it's the one they were determined to nullify.
The most serious allegation, if I may, is that in pursuing the scientific journalism where you're getting nearly the entire archive rather than just selected little snippets, is that they released unredacted the names of informants and protected sources in places like Afghanistan or Iraq, where that could be very dangerous for people's identities to be disclosed. And so that, in the early days, you don't hear it anymore, but in the early days that formed quite a significant part of the US message, was that this is risky, it's dangerous, it's irresponsible, people could get hurt. And then in court filings, more than once, they had to admit under oath that actually nobody's been harmed in the publication of these documents. But what they say in front of cameras, what they say under oath to a court, are two very different things. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of cloudy disinformation and misinformation around the work. But ultimately, WikiLeaks, apart from the kind of the innovations that we've been discussing, didn't do anything that New York Times and the Washington Post haven't been doing, which is why the Obama administration was so reluctant to prosecute.
Mm. Yep. WikiLeaks and also Annika Smethurst, the AFP raids, that ABC and so many other instances of the state crashing down on individuals or institutions because of national security, when things simply turn out to be either just embarrassing or uncomfortable. Scott, you worked in government for so long. How much is kept secret from us?
Well, a great deal. And a lot of it is kept secret under this shroud of what they call national security. Mm. And the definition of what I understood that to be seems to be very different to how it's used in at a press conference by the Prime Minister on down. You know, they claimed that Bernard Collaery and Witness K had to be prosecuted and have their lives destroyed through a national security matter. What they mean by national security is Australian spies tasked with providing commercial intelligence to the gas industry to help them in negotiations with the Timorese. That gets shrouded under this thing that they call national security. And we've seen this over and over again. Commercial espionage or character assassination or disclosing SAS war crimes in Afghanistan, you can be an Australian journalist and have them come through your door with a search warrant to go through your stuff. So what they're doing to Julian and his colleagues is a particularly extreme example of a relatively common behaviour. Mm. Power hates having its secrets disclosed, and yet that is what publishers are for. That's what journalists are for.
Every federal government since 2010 has been hopeless on this issue with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. What should we be learning about how power works in Australia from that reaction?
Is that if we stay quiet, they'll continue to roll over us. They only respect a popular campaign. They only respect pressure. Mm. There's certainly no principle involved. I don't know what you think, Peter, but...
Well, I mean, Julia Gillard made statements that you know, WikiLeaks was breaking the law and all sorts of things. So, but, you know, behind the claims like that are made easily, and they're easily picked up by reporters and published without any response from the other side all too often. And, you know, the demonisation and the abandonment of Julian Assange has been an incredible, terrifying warning to journalists. Then the raids on the ABC and Anita Smethurst, they basically told journalists, you're the enemy. We don't want you to tell the truth, and we're going to do what we can to stop you. So whilst they smash into WikiLeaks, they're quite happy to send in the the AFP into the, through the front doors of the ABC and to investigate some journalists, not for embarrassing stories, but for stories about war crimes done by Australians. Mm. So they were very tough stories, and they wanted them shut down, just like they wanted the stories on the Canberra bubble shut down. They want these stories shut down. They don't want the public to know, because we have a democracy and people vote. So secrecy is it's sort of the bread and butter of politics and government, sad to say. And press releases and spin doctoring and setting the narrative is a major part of their goal. So when a journalist or a WikiLeaks wanders along with a fact, then they'll do whatever they can to stop that. You know, there's a whole set of facts of reality happening, and it's like there's a tide above that and you only see little islands pop through occasionally. But they don't want us to drain that, you know. They don't want us to drain that swamp. They don't want those facts to be known. There's some horrible things that are not public yet. And, you know, journalists are trying to find ways to tell some of those stories. WikiLeaks has told some amazing things. Mm. One of my favourites, and I'll jump into this, is the revelation that the United States Embassy developed contacts within the Labor Party, secret contacts, a number of them. And for years and years, people of my age and older had wondered about the Whitlam government. Was it subverted? Was the CIA interested? And did the embassy talk to Hawke and organise him against Whitlam? There are all these sort of suggestions, and no one could really nail it beyond opinions of people involved. Okay, time passes. Here we are, 2010, I think, and bang, we have chapter and verse of documents, State Department documents released through WikiLeaks, and written by a terrific reporter, Phil Dorling, for Fairfax, then Fairfax, and setting out how members, senior members of the Labor Party were having secret meetings with the US Embassy, informing them of the most intimate detail of factional power deals being done, giving profiles of Julia Gillard 12 months into the reign of Kevin Rudd. And some of these contacts were the ones involved in the, you know, the coup against Rudd. Now, we'd all just be guessing at that without those leaks. We'd be guessing, and we'd be told we were conspiracy theorists. And it's hard to argue against a document. Mm. So those documents just have been one of the most valuable things for me to understand. And now, as a journalist, I realise, well, crikey, the US Embassy is getting out there and collecting intelligence for whatever purposes and making friends. And it popped up again fairly recently when it was revealed by the Herald again that a leak on the Wuhan lab document that was released came from the US Embassy, was given by the US Embassy to the Murdoch media. Now, that's meant to influence us. Thankfully, some journos discovered that and outed it. So, you know, the role of the WikiLeaks, the role of journalists in outing these things is, it's not crucial to democracy. It is democracy. We don't have it if we don't know. Mm. So the WikiLeaks example is one we shouldn't forget, and that's the purpose of the book, in that, you know, time had passed and people had sort of forgotten about it. People thought WikiLeaks was just the story of Julian Assange's cat. Well, I know bugger all about Lachlan Murdoch's cat. You know, like, who cares about, you know, the foibles of an owner of an outlet are really distractions, and they're meant to be distractions, and the media jumps on the bait all too often. So
it's so important, though, to understand the demonisation of Julian Assange from government, that this has been a carefully curated, thought out, I mean, they don't call it a policy, but it hasn't happened by accident that so much doubt about his character has been sown. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about that, but also what is much more mystifying to me, and that is the media never taking up his cause fully and completely. It is an absolute mystery to me that this can lapse where a journalist, a publisher, is languishing in a terrible, terrible situation. Mm. Can you explain that? Why the media, why fellow journalists have not made this an absolute priority?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to you first, Peter, because you're the journo, well, and then Scott can speak to the politics.
There was a terrific Four Corners done about 10 years ago by Andrew Fowler, who's one of the chapter writers in the book, another former ABC person who feels freed up to now talk.
Although 10 years ago was before...
But he looked at the allegations of rape.
Mm.
He looked at that story. And if you dial back into the ABC website, you can find that story. It is the definitive story about those allegations. But everyone's... Other journalists forget it and move on and resurface them as though they're new, credible allegations. So there has been some good work done, and there's been some really rugged, patchy work done. There's a groupthink at the ABC, not surprising. It's a large organisation, and a lot of... I think once Julian Assange had those accusations made against him of rape, baseless... But made and the leaks around the tactics of Clinton and the Democratic Party in trying to get her elected, I think a lot of people who take a pro-feminist left centre-left stance decided going too far, we're not going to support that, and that view became predominant within the organisation. Not everyone. There's some excellent people who really, you know, only want the truth. But there's a few people who kind of think, oh, gosh, this guy might be a journalist. He might be putting out information, but he's getting a bit too big for his boots. So there's a sort of an element of that, you know. The Media Alliance gave him a Walkley and, you know, he's been promoted as being doing good journalism, and a lot of journalists... who criticise him have never broken a story in their life. So it's it is sad that he's been abandoned, but it's part of the campaign.
I mean, interestingly, that Walkley went to WikiLeaks, I think. It didn't go to Julian Assange.
Yeah.
It's troubling what you're saying, Peter. I find what about you, Scott?
It did go to the whole team, and it's important to remember that Julian's the one in Belmarsh, but there is a team. There was a collective effort, and it remains so. I think definitely the element of fear and that element of groupthink is there. I also think it's worth acknowledging that every time there's a development in that case, it leads news bulletins in every time zone in the world. It's a top story. When he was ripped out of the embassy, the process tracking through his various court appearances, the appeal in January, there is a very high level of agreement and of interest, I think. And even if publishers aren't out there campaigning on it, and I wish they would more, there's still, I think, a recognition that this is a huge story and it's in the public interest that people know, and people will click on that stuff. They want to know what's going on. In the US at the moment, even though I wish they would go harder and I wish they would talk about it more, the New York Times, the Washington Post, a number of big US mastheads and kind of opinion setters in the US have signed on to statements. You know, they are editorialising in favour of Julian because they know the crosshairs are on them as well. So I think that sense of self-interest is settling in, which was exactly what Biden and Obama decided before Trump was elected, is that if you prosecute WikiLeaks, you've driven a bus through the First Amendment that protects every other publisher in the United States. So I think they are coming around. I don't think it's so completely bleak as some might suggest. But we can help set that agenda by writing letters to the editor, by getting on Talkback Radio, by sharing these stories on social media and making sure that we're doing our bit. We're all publishers now. Peter shared this piece this morning from 2010. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
The only person who comes out of that story looking good, ironically enough, is Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
But protected sources thing. It's like these Labor Party moles snitching to US embassy officials about a coup that hasn't happened yet and won't happen for months.
Mm.
that stuff is deeply in the public interest to know about.
Yeah, it is. Julian Assange ought to be a hero to every Australian journalist, but there's others, you know, who should be heroes who are forgotten as well. And it's kind of a natural thing of journalists. The journalists want to do good themselves, so they're not going to keep on praising a Julian Assange. I mean, I think there are more journalists becoming aware of the extraordinarily brutal treatment being meted out to Julian Assange. Just the terrible treatment he's going under of isolation, of not being able to access legal papers and being strip searched and all the things that are going on. He's a journalist and he's not being found guilty of anything. So what the hell is he in a terrorist's jail, high security jail in England for? It's an outrage. And people like Kevin Rudd, you say, I mean, and others, you know, say he shouldn't be there and should be allowed his freedom again. But the powers that be that didn't like what he was leaking are powerful. And so the pressure, you know, you can read amazing stories about the pressure that's been on the British government to keep him locked up and ready to be sent across the Atlantic. Yes. If he goes, he'll die. He'll die in jail in America, whether it be by his own hand, through his own state, or through mistreatment. But his life is at risk now. He's not been found guilty of anything. Mm. How about that? Amazing.
For every day he's there too, it's a reminder to every other journalist, yeah, isn't it, and every other publisher. How big a deterrent is that, do you think?
Well, if you wanted to break a national security story involving US war crimes, there's your object lesson in how you'll be treated and how your government will just pretend that you don't exist. So it's clearly the piece that I'd put into the book is about the purpose of repression. It's to provoke fear. It's to set an example of somebody to terrify the rest of us. That's principally why they're doing it. And that repression does have a habit of blowing up in the face of the repressor. If instead of choosing fear, we choose rage, instead of choosing fear, we choose defiance, then that's the example that we choose to set. Mm. So we're not there yet. We don't have that critical mass, but I find there's some really encouraging and positive signs. First time in a decade, Anthony Albanese and his Shadow Attorney General spokesperson, Mark Dreyfus, have broken with the coalition and said, this is enough, he's got to come home now. Mm. Now, I don't know what they're doing with that. I don't know what actions are happening behind the scenes, but credit where it's due. Morrison's on his own now. The opposition and a majority of the crossbench, the Greens for a decade, have been saying this is a disaster, not just for Julian, having lost a decade of his life and is unable to see his kids and his partner, but for anybody proposing to do national security journalism or expose the crimes of the powerful. Mm. So credit where it's due. Bipartisanship is broken. We now have to go all out to encourage the government. You know, John Howard picked up the phone in the end and got David Hicks out of Guantanamo Bay. Hicks is photographed with a rocket launcher over his shoulder in Afghanistan. A hard case. And eventually, years too late, we got him home. And we have to get Julian home.
Yeah. I think what's happening with Julian Assange is a good illustration of where Australia sits in the broad international power structure of empire. We have the United States gets its way. And if they want to get a journalist who's not committed a crime in the US... obviously publishing on the internet is available in the US, hasn't been in the US committing a crime, is not a US citizen, they just want to reach out and pluck up that journalist and pull him back and drop him in Guantanamo or wherever, then what's to stop any other journalist being treated the same way? Now, luckily, a lot of good journalists have said, well, stuff that, we'll just keep on reporting. And I think that's got to be the attitude, that on one hand, push politicians and people here to speak up and try to get him released, but on the other hand, smash through the barrier of secrecy and keep publishing the secrets they don't want. And the Afghanistan files that the ABC did, I don't want to pat their back, but they did a great job. And after the raids on the ABC and the investigation of a couple of journalists, which looked like were going to end up in court, the ABC published more. Published more, showed the killing of an unarmed man on the ground. So, you know, that's extraordinary. I've never seen that sort of thing on national television before, and it's happened after the crackdown. So I think crackdowns can happen, and I think they can stifle voices and all sorts of things, but I think journalists with support, and it's not just the ABC, there's other places, obviously 60 Minutes, Nick McKenzie and co have done a brilliant job. But we got to know what the risks they're taking. I mean, they know the risks they're taking of being raided or charged or having their lives threatened, you know. It can be pretty tough at times. So not ignoring the struggles that are going on in Australia is also a good thing that people should consider. WikiLeaks has shown what can happen, and those battles are still underway with other journalists doing other stories here in Australia.
Mm. You mentioned just before, Scott, the First Amendment in the US. We have no such problem here because, of course, we don't have that kind of protection in our constitution. What kind of changes would you like to see, legislative changes, constitutional changes, to protect people?
Yeah,
and
it's fascinating, isn't it? So the US is insisting that they have extraterritorial reach, that they can grab this Australian journalist who wasn't even publishing on US soil, prosecute him under US law, but because he's not a US citizen, he won't be given the benefit of First Amendment protection. They seriously are trying to do that. In Australia, I think we're now about 100 years overdue for a discussion about a Bill of Rights, something either embedded in the Constitution or appended to the Constitution. And I've come to it, I guess, a little bit laterally through the conversation about digital rights, that we've got this whole suite of quite invasive technologies. Most of us are carrying these very high-resolution tracking devices around with us at every minute of the day. And those digital traces that we leave are swarming with cops in a completely unregulated way, hundreds of thousands of times a year. That metadata is being scooped up and analysed, huge clouds of it. That the rights discussion in Australia is miles behind where the technology is. And it means that whether it be around Edward Snowden or Julian, for that matter, the discussion in the US and in Europe is far more sophisticated than the conversation here. So there are moves, there are broad-based moves to introduce a Bill of Rights here in Australia. It was something that was, you know, again, one of Kevin Rudd's ideas that kind of got discarded by the side of the road. But let's press that. Let's advance that. Because at the moment we've got people think that we have these constitutional protections that we simply don't.
Mm. And we've got a government and opposition, whoever's in power at the time, who basically are in lockstep on surveillance and security legislation, you know. Every party, when it's in opposition, seems too afraid to object to the next crackdown. I mean, there's something like, at the last count, last year, there was 78, I think, laws that had been brought in under the terrorism justification that impinged on free speech.
Mm.
I mean, I can't keep up with them. I mean, you know, I've probably misspoken today.
There's that side, isn't there? And then you think about the COVID pandemic and data collection
incredible.
Under the public health emergency. I sort of wonder whether in 30 years' time, when people speak of 2020, the actual illness will be the main story, or that some of the things that happened in the shadows of it.
Well, other people have said, never let a good crisis go to waste. So, I mean,
once you bring in that of norms.
We all accept lockdowns now, if there's a good reason. And
well, not even so much. I'm Melbourne. I do accept a good lockdown. I'm thinking more about the acquiescence of just the digital, the every time we sign in, you did it today, that where is this information landing? How will it be used? Mm. We're told that it will never be used for anything other than tracking COVID, but there's plenty of evidence in WikiLeaks to show that information of that scale is never let gone to waste. Is that the kind of thing that, you know, people should be concerned about?
Yeah, I believe it is. is the, you know, additional dimensions of surveillance and monitoring and control introduced under, you know, I signed the barcode on MOAN and I checked the list of venues that the fellow in Sydney had visited because I was there within, there only a couple of days after he'd been around. So I feel like, okay, there's legitimate public health reasons for doing this, so I'm going to participate, sign the thing. And the trick is that other agendas kind of creeping in underneath that, taking advantage of that collective goodwill that we've all demonstrated, try and keep ourselves safe in a pandemic, that are then used for completely different agendas. So, yeah, always look at the terms and conditions, because you're right, Sally. These things get introduced, they're formidably difficult to roll back. There's big blocks of that anti-terrorism legislation that John Howard introduced in 2001 that have never been used, that are still on the statute books. Now, how on earth are we meant to get rid of that stuff once it's in? So our best bet is to fight and contest each new initiative as it comes in, and we're doing a reasonable job of that in the case of the encryption. The government's dead keen on cracking down and making encryption more difficult so that we can't communicate securely. And the other one to keep a big eye on is facial recognition. So networked facial recognition linked to all the surveillance cameras that are now in the urban environment that are automatically or algorithmically scanning everybody's faces to see if you're a person of interest. We still have the chance to win those arguments, but it's very difficult to win them once they're in place.
At the more traditional level of journalism, Peter, and I'm thinking in press galleries, particularly between journalists and government, there's a lot of practices in the way it works at the moment that just between journalists and politicians and staff chip away at democracy every single day, that it's a sort of bartering system, an exchange of I'll give you this if you don't do that. And, I mean, how does this contribute to secrecy?
Yeah, there's a little bit too much cosiness in the corridors of Canberra. Between journos and the media staff of politicians. And, you know, I think you shouldn't have local journos hired in the Canberra Gallery. Yep. They should be from out of town.
Shouldn't have an ABC program which is called Inside.
No, that's a classic, isn't it? And that the people should be rotated on a very regular basis so they can burn their bridges. They don't have to be nice all the time to get access. They can actually ask tough questions at a media conference and then not be invited. That's what happened to The Guardian.
Yes.
The Guardian would turn up because they're not gallery journalists. They're very experienced. They came in when The Guardian got going and they were never told about press conferences. They never got the drops. They didn't know what was going on. Obviously, other journalists told them. But there's myriad ways of cutting journalists cold and trying to ruin their careers, but not by not helping them, especially if you're a high profile and you need access and need information. So, yeah, it's a really tough relationship. And I think it causes problems, probably causes a lot of problems. There's some terrific reporters in the gallery, and there's some others. And I think the problem that you raise about too much cosiness and people letting things drift showed with the stories that the ABC did at the end of last year on the Canberra bubble. You know, that stuff wasn't new.
Let's just get back a bit to some legislative change, Scott, because I think we got meandered off a bit too of what... what other things you would like to see introduced, media laws and the kind of things I suppose Peter Grester talks a lot about in his work, what we need here.
Yeah, there's other people who are much closer to the front line of that work who'd be better placed. So there's an alliance of human rights groups and legal scholars around the country who are advancing draft rights framework for Australia that would cover all of us, that like the citizenship entitlements that would cover everything from free speech, which the right seems so intent on singling out as the most important one, but also the right to privacy, the freedom to organise with whoever we choose, and to actually bed down legally guaranteed human rights frameworks. So there's there's frameworks out there, they're in draft and they're being put together, and I think let's raise the profile of that at every opportunity, something very broad-based. Digital rights are human rights, you know, whether it's a conversation on a phone or a conversation over a coffee. We have the right, we should have the right, guaranteed by law, to have these conversations without being spied on by the state.
I've got a question texted in here from Barry. Thank you, Barry. What responsibility and influence do media owners like Rupert Murdoch have in this scenario?
Oh, read the first essay in the book. So it's by Philip Adams, who's, I hadn't tweaked to this before, but he said that the two most important media figures in the world at the moment, isn't it odd that they're both Australian? Julian Assange, freezing in a cell at risk of death in London, Rupert Murdoch on some mega yacht somewhere with his mobile phone and his empire, orchestrating things like that guy in The Simpsons, both Australians. Mm. One's repudiated his citizenship, one has been abandoned by the source of his citizenship. And here's this guy with this empire who could literally flick an editorial switch and bring this to an end. You know, if that entire suite of that media empire suddenly got behind Julian, he would be out in a week. So stop buying that guy's stuff, really.
Anything you'd like to add about Uncle Rupert, Peter?
He'll die soon, but... But the organisation will continue. Nothing will change. And in fact, it may become further to the far right. It's already in the far right now, but it may go further. Look, they do a beautiful job at what they do. Sometimes I'm in awe of the headlines that they can somehow get out of an issue, you know. Like if you believe, was there a beauty on China the other day? I get entertained by it and depressed at the same time. It's so, you know, media ownership in Australia was a problem when I was doing my first journalism degree in the 70s. And nothing, it's got so much worse now.
Well, we've got there's a question that somebody's texted into regarding that traditional media is being dealt hard blows, and it's dealing some as well, I suppose, but social media has character limits. To ensure journalism continues as independent in this country, where are the platforms or the formats that people can flee to?
Well, there's a thriving independent media. I mean, there are a bunch of terrific websites that are really worthwhile staying in touch with, and, you know, ranging from Michael West Media to, I mean, Crikey, and, you know, there's all sorts. And really worthwhile diving into them because they're doing journalism and they're doing it on a click for, you know, they're getting small subscriptions and they're actually making it work. The model is beginning to work. They're surviving on the smell of an oily rag, but, you know... I would suggest people have a look at them because they are filling some of the gaps. If they think mainstream are not quite getting there, then have a look. You know, the reporting on corruption by the Michael West media group of journalists who work with him is astounding. I mean, it's far more than I've seen in the mainstream media. There's so much going on. I mean, they just list just case after case after case after case of corruption that I haven't heard about before through mainstream. No, that's not good enough. So, yeah, you can fill the gaps. You have to just work at it. It's a bit harder, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Crikey is another one. Any subscribers to the Saturday paper? Yeah, good. Show of hands, about half the room. How about the other half? Like, Peter's dead right. The work is being done.
We can hunt it down.
Yeah, hunt it down. We can amplify it, share it. And oh, anybody on social media, you're also a publisher now. Think about that.
A text from Michelle also preempting that Philip Adams, what he said about Rupert and Julian Assange. Scott, I want to ask you, I know that this is a subject of your book, but I'm really interested in relation to this topic as well about social movements. Mm. It's a fascinating topic.
It is.
I studied it at uni and...
I didn't. I'm just making it up.
Oh, it was... It really is... even since I was at uni a couple of years ago, it's changed, obviously, what's been happening. But tell me what interests you about... I mean, we're living in a Me Too, Black Lives Matters, climate change. How can you get this issue as part of a movement that is, it's a harder sell, isn't it? Can you talk about
that?
Yeah,
it is a little bit, but I think just from my narrower experience with Extinction Rebellion, for example, one of their platforms is Tell the Truth. Tell the truth about the climate emergency. I see XR sharing WikiLeaks-related material all the time because that's their purpose. Mm. Tell the truth. Some of it's ugly and hard to look at and hard to sit with, but tell the truth. Start with that. So I think there is this crossover, and certainly it's worth emphasising it, leaning into it. If we can't communicate with each other safely, if we can't organise safely, if we can't choose our sources of information... then we're lost. No other campaign has a chance of surviving, whether it be for climate or for First Nations justice or for a bit of patriarchy smashing. If we can't freely communicate with each other, then all these other things are lost. Mm. Worth emphasising and, you know, worth being very clear about it.
Mm. Yeah. I was just remembering in the book there's a... Is it Benedetta Brevini writes really, really great chapter about the consequences of our concentrated media?
Yeah, yeah. No, she's a great expert on that, Benny. And I always thought it would get better, but the trends of, I guess, profit making means that that they gobble up. You know, Murdoch gobbled up the independent regional newspapers and then closed them.
Well, also not profit-making too, isn't it? That, you know, Murdoch's prepared to take such a loss.
Well, if you're a propaganda news sheet, you're not there to make money.
No.
You're there to influence the world.
That's right.
And that they do a great job at doing that.
Mm.
The profit model, that's right. They subsidise their loss-making outlets, The Australian and so forth.
Mm. There's another text question about... where Julian Assange's case is at the moment and what we might expect, what you expect.
Not a lawyer, obviously, but Julian won his case in January.
Mm.
So the US proposing to extradite him, that's why they've been holding him in Belmarsh for more than 2 years. To our enormous surprise, the magistrate in London said no. So he accepted absolutely chapter and verse of the prosecution's argument, which is terrifying, the precedent that's been set. The arguments that she agreed to effectively redefine publishing as espionage. It's got really serious consequences if that's all upheld. But then, on the last line of argument, denied the extradition request, as Peter pointed out before, because he simply wouldn't survive the process. The US prison system is so utterly sadistic that even as the course of the legal proceedings in the US... unfold, she upheld the argument of the defence that he simply wouldn't survive the process. So what we're waiting for now, so right before that had happened, obviously the Trump administration, the senior officials that advanced that prosecution were thrown out of office in quite a big swing in the United States. Trump is back in Florida doing lots of cocaine, presumably, and also kicked off social media. And we have a new Attorney General, we have a new administration, new officials running most of the key agencies. So we're waiting for the US and for the US Department of Justice to tell us what their grounds of appeal are going to be. And then the British court, higher court, has to decide whether or not to accept that they will hear the appeal. So in London, this still has months to go, unless that court, unless two things could happen. One is the US, the Biden administration could say, you know what? This was a bad idea. This was a Trump decision. We don't have to own it. We're done. He's done 10 years in various forms of incarceration. Cut him loose. That could happen. The British courts could, in fact, hear an appeal argument by the US and turn it down. which I find kind of unlikely. Or they could appeal. The British court could say, yes, let's hear the appeal. And Julian Assange, sometime in the next few months, dies in Belmarsh. I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but that's what the court agreed was the most likely outcome. So it's, yes, it's a legal process, but it's a deeply human process unfolding. I want to invite all of us today to consider whether we will choose fear or whether we will choose rage and defiance, like each one of us individually. Sit with it for a little bit. Don't leave the auditorium and head off to the next session and have had a nice morning. We're not here to be comfortable.
And, I mean, along with Julian, it seems that there's a moment we're experiencing right now where freedom of speech, the shutting down and jailing of people who have advocated, I'm thinking of people like young Joshua Wong in Hong Kong and a lot of his colleagues. I mean, this is happening everywhere. But so is the availability of information, you know, which one is tugging. I mean, in some ways, Julian Assange's case, how it goes, may well end up, signifying which way this goes. Peter, do you have a sense of optimism or?
Oh, yeah, of course. Always optimistic, but it was said by supporters of Julian Assange that this is terrible, it'll be used as a precedent. And people went, oh, no, it won't. It's happening. There's lots of examples now. The latest one I've just seen is the president of Azerbaijan has just come out and cracked down on journalists, and I think he jailed a whole bunch of people for no particular strong reason. And when he was criticised internationally, he came out and said, well, Britain is doing this and the United States are doing this to Julian Assange, a journalist, so don't criticise me. Yeah. So we all worried that this would be a precedent. It's moved beyond that now. It's spreading. Now, journalists have always been an enemy to truth, but they're, truth isn't going to be enough to free us, sad to say. It's got to be action. It's got to be people taking part, equipped with the truth, then taking part in our democracy, taking part in our media through tweeting and putting in letters to the editor and writing articles if people are up to that. Participating is freedom, really. Yes. That's where it comes from. Is it worse? Yes, it's worse. Are journalists being threatened more? Yes, I think they are. Are the tools to repress them stronger? Yes. iPhone in the pocket, all of that. But through the backing of the audience and people, the community, journalists can keep doing it. And Julian can be freed. And WikiLeaks leaks can continue. And we can continue to see what's going on and empower more action. So overall, yeah, it's very optimistic, I think, despite where we are.
I think often it's forgotten that you don't have to be in jail to have an experience as a journalist really wreck your life. I mentioned Annika Smith-Hirst before, who was the her house was raided by the AFP, and she spent months not knowing, the federal government threatening that she'd be charged and that she would go to prison for having published a document on and a classic case, wasn't it, of the Australian right to know that the government were discussing, talking about changing, basically spying on Australians instead of just allowing spying on other people. And
It's enormously intimidating, and it's meant to be.
I mean, it was really awful what happened to her. She's spoken about this publicly and written about it. It was a new apartment. It was her first ever apartment that she'd lived in alone, and she'd only just moved into that apartment, and she never spent another night there again. And, these are really the human consequences of this treatment of protecting your sources and protecting your story. And, of course, equally importantly, her phone stopped ringing. and it affected her work terribly because every politician in the land just probably correctly assumed her phone was bugged. Mm. So, I mean, these kind... And, Peter, you would have seen this over the years, wouldn't you?
Look, I know of an example at Four Corners the day after the raid that we had. You know, we watched it, we saw it. The day after, a very good person who wanted to tell their story cancelled their interview. So the chilling effect was immediate. People who felt they wanted to tell their story saw it as well. So it wasn't just terrifying to some journalists, it was terrifying to people in the community who had a story to tell. So it's not done because it doesn't work, it works. These crackdowns work, but with the broad support of the community, journalists can keep on doing it and will keep doing it. You know, the strength is there. That's why journalists do this stuff, generally speaking. The fight's got to continue, but, boy, the pressure's... I've never seen the pressure like it is, you know. I mean, tracking device in my pocket, none of my emails are confidential. I mean, what sort of a dystopian world is that?
Mm.
And it's all due to terrorism. You know, it's... Anika Smethurst's leak that she published was the Australian Signals Directorate, which basically looks after foreign international communications, and so it spies on those sorts of things for us. And particular people who are still very prominent in Canberra wanted to allow that Defence Department foreign surveillance agency to turn its eyes inward on Australian citizens. Now, they deny it and they jump around, and but you can read the document. She published a bit of the document in the paper, and you can see that's precisely what they wanted to do. And at the same time, we're developing relationships with other Five Eyes countries and sharing that intelligence. So, you know, there's a lot going on, and we've got to fight every step to keep Australia as free and open as we kind of think it will be naturally. Well, it ain't going to be natural.
Well, I like that between the two of you, you know, there's optimism and rage. I urge you all to get a copy of this book in your hands, A Secret Australia, revealed by the WikiLeaks expose. The opening lines of Scott's essay, every act of repression offers a choice between retreat or defiance, fear or anger. And I think we'll leave you with that choice to go off and make. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks,
you all for being such a wonderful audience, and have a great festival. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Yeah. Wonderful.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Sally Warhaft in conversation with Peter Cronow and Scott Ludlam, that took place on Sunday, the 9th of May, as part of Bendigo Writers Festival. Visit WheelerCentre.com for more upcoming events.